On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Microsoft has a pink slip problem, the United States has a hacking problem, and IDIS Network comes in studio to tell you how to protect the Internet of Things. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 108, recorded September 19th, 2014, for September 22nd. IDIS, the Internet of Things. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by IT Pro TV. Are you looking to upgrade your IT skills or prepare for certification? IT Pro TV offers engaging and informative tutorials streamed to your Roku, computer, or mobile device. For 30% off the lifetime of your account, go to itpro.tv/enterprise and use the code ENTERPRISE30. And by TechServe, the world's largest independent Apple retailer and professional services provider. Go to techserve.com/twyatt-7sins to get access to the free ebook on the 7 deadly sins of iPad deployment. And by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get a loan. Welcome to Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I'm not guiding you alone. I've got plenty of help, starting with my good friend and cohort, Mr. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Brian, what is this? What have you got up in your face right now?
Yeah, it's a new marking tape. You stick it onto metal, hit it with a laser, and it leaves what looks like anodizing behind at 1,000 dots per inch.
It's like a sintering tape. What is this?
Well, yeah, you know all that marking that you see on the back of iPhones and things like that. You think it's etched, but it's not. That's this stuff.
That's actually pretty cool. That's what you've been playing around with recently.
Yeah, actually, we're putting it onto stainless steel, and then we're going to see how well it handles biofouling and use it for marking our cables and things like that on underwater observatories. But in the meantime, I'm going to make some really cool keychains.
Very cool. Now, a man who I know is not involved with biofouling is Mr. Curtis Franklin over on the right coast of the country. Curtis, it is good to see you, my friend. Thank you for staying up for this special edition of This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Happy to do it, Padre. I can't imagine a better way to spend my Friday evening, which tells you just how sad my life has become.
Oh, it's not sad at all. This is the life of the enterprise. Speaking of the life of the enterprise, let's get straight into the first blip. This one comes to us from CNN Money, talking about how Oracle founder Larry Ellison has stepped down as CEO. After 37 years in the top spot, Larry Ellison is stepping down as CEO of Oracle, a company that he founded in 1977. The fifth richest person in the world, worth a cool $51 billion, is splitting the CEO spot between Safra Kars, who has been Oracle president since 2005, and Mark Hurd, who was dumped from his CEO gig at HP in 2010. Ellison will become the executive chairman of Oracle's board and take the job of CTO.
So we're going to go from a part-time Hawaii resident to an article by Digital Trends when they interviewed the Microsoft CEO, Satya Nadella, on why he doesn't care about the Windows Phone market share. In what would seem a counterintuitive statement, Satya Nadella went on to say that it's not about market share, but more about creating the mobile ecosystem. Mobility is what seems to matter in the long run, and creating the ecosystem to support it is what Microsoft is concerned about. At a measly 2.7% global market share, the Windows Phone seems to be all but ignored by the market. However, what I think we're going to see is Microsoft using Windows Phone as a platform to leverage their cloud and operating system experience to extend the enterprise into the mobile world in ways Android or Apple so far seem incapable of doing. As a Windows Phone fanboy and member of the press, I have seen some amazing features creep into the ecosystem, and I, for one, can't wait for my Windows Phone 8.1 update if T-Mobile will ever release it. Mr. Nadella, here's hoping Microsoft vindicates my choice of Windows Phone in the very near future.
As the price of a gigabyte of storage gets closer and closer to zero, hard drive manufacturers are looking for ways to bolster their razor-thin margins. And that might be bad news for purveyors of storage arrays. In the past 3 weeks, Seagate has acquired high-end enterprise data array company Xytex and SMB network outfit LaCie. Hitachi has partnered with Amplidata and Avere to create an enterprise storage solution, and WD Western Digital has started a NAS product line. All of this points to the fact that hard drive manufacturers are tired of selling their drives for just above cost to OEMs who make 100 to 1,000 times more on the markup.
Speaking of ways to use all that big data that you're storing, according to Mary Jo Foley of All About Microsoft, customers of Microsoft's Azure cloud services will soon have a comprehensive big data service available for their existing accounts. The newly developed Azure Data Factory will allow users to consolidate their various analytics and data pipelines into a single service that can analyze Azure on-premise and select third-party products into a single pane of glass. Although Microsoft is not commenting on the service at this time, Mary Jo Foley's sources state that the service is in private preview to be released publicly in the next few months.
And Big Blue has a message for some of its employees. Learn up and learn to live on less. On Wednesday, a memo was circulated through the strategic outsourcing arm of IBM's Global Technology Services Division. Managers and employees who received the memo were told of a recent performance assessment that found that certain workers were, quote, failing to keep pace with acquiring the skills and expertise needed to address changing client needs, technology, and market requirements. The memo would continue, ominously, you have been identified as one of those employees. All who received the memo were then told that they would be required to dedicate one day per week, for up to 23 days, for skills and expertise development. During that time, they would be docked 10% of their pay to make up for the missing day of productivity. Employees have complained that the move is an underhanded way to deal with overstaffing, but with IBM expected to cut 15,000 jobs before the end of 2014, it's either learn and take the temporary pay cut or take your skills elsewhere. Now that's it for the blips. Let's take some time now to thank the first sponsor of the Twiat Riot. Now, one of the questions that we get asked most often here on Twiat, be it here on the show, in our Twitter accounts, or when Curtis and Brian and I go to Interop or Enterprise Connect is, well, how do I break into the enterprise field? It's hard. I mean, there's a lot of terminology that you have to learn. There's a lot of technology that you have to play with, and it can seem incredibly daunting to get a toehold into turning this into your job. Well, thankfully, we've got IT Pro TV. Well, IT Pro TV is a video network that's dedicated exclusively to helping you find your way in the world of information technology. Whether you're looking to jumpstart a career in IT or you're already working in the field, IT Pro TV supplements traditional learning methods in a fun and engaging way that maximizes your learning and prepares you for certification exams. IT Pro TV offers hundreds of hours of content, with 30 hours being added each week. They have an extensive and growing episode library with video courses on Apple, Microsoft, Cisco, and more, with course topics that cover practical subjects like network security, Linux, Windows, and OS X support for desktops and servers, and dozens of other real-world situations. But this ain't no sterile certification manual or textbook. IT Pro TV hosts tell engaging stories. They share their experiences, which is what makes it possible to remember the information. This is Learning 101. This is how you make sure you know how things get done. Now, their episode library is organized by exam objectives, which makes it easy for you to target your trouble areas, better preparing you to pass your certification test. And they also have a virtual machine sandbox. It's a virtual environment that allows you to have virtual hands-on experience with the gear that costs millions and millions of dollars, gear you'd never have on your own in your own home lab. So if you want to know how to do it, IT Pro TV will actually let you configure the gear that gets you the job that lets you learn. Now, because of this lesson targeting and because of this virtual experience, even if you're already studying with a book or enrolled in a certification program, IT Pro TV is the perfect compliment. It's a way to learn that's different from just having someone talk to you. It's you using that information and committing it to memory and understanding how things actually work. Now, if this all sounds familiar to you, well, there's a reason for that. IT Pro TV are huge fans of TWiT, and they've taken our method, our process, our TriCaster, our cameras, and they've applied it to enterprise tech. And, well, that's just why they love the TWiT Army. How much do they love us? They love us so much that they're giving you a no-hassle, no-muss, no-fuss, easy cancellation policy. They're giving you free measure-up practice exams with your subscription. That's a $79 value. And if you subscribe for the annual plan, you can download episodes and audio-only MP3s for online consumption. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to check out itpro.tv/enterprise. That's itpro.tv/enterprise. And upgrade your brain with the most popular certifications recognized by employers. There's also a free preview on the site if you want to check out some of their videos or their live stream. And subscriptions are normally $57 per month or $570 for an entire year. But they have a special offer for you because you're part of the TWiT Army. If you sign up now and use the code ENTERPRISE30, you'll receive 30% off your subscription for the lifetime of your account. That's less than $40 per month or $399 for the entire year. That's itpro.tv/enterprise and use the code ENTERPRISE30 to receive 30% off. And we thank IT Pro TV for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Let's get back to it. Curtis, Brian, we've got an enterprise bite here that's, it's a little bit sad, especially since we all have friends who work for Microsoft, and I think we all have friends who have been affected by the story. We know that Microsoft has hit the second round of their layoffs. A few months back, Satya Nadella came out and said that they were going to chop 18,000 jobs from the software giant. Well, they made 13,000 cuts in the first round. This is the second round, and they chopped 2,100. And unfortunately, that chop has affected some of their research. The first story is about Microsoft acknowledging that the Silicon Valley Research Center is one of the entities to be shuttered. That Valley office was one of a number of research outposts around the world that attempted to use local talent to develop new technologies, methodologies, and processes. Employing 50 people, that particular center was focused on research dealing mainly with the privacy, security, protocols, fault tolerance, concurrency, architecture, and theory of distributed computing. This doesn't remove Microsoft from the Silicon Valley. They still have about 2,500 employees working on Microsoft products like Bing, Skype, Outlook, Xbox, and Yammer. But it does raise a bunch of questions as to why Microsoft would axe a group that seems to be kind of key to the future of the development of the Redmond giant. Chibert, let me start with you. How do you see this? I mean, I understand every company needs to lay off every once in a while. Every company gets a bit bloated. But to cut on research, it seems kind of short-sighted.
I got to imagine that Microsoft's going to take some of the best and brightest out of those groups and roll them into other groups. Because remember, research doesn't stay research forever. Research has to become a product someday, especially on a profit-driven company like Microsoft. Even some of the research grants that I worked on for DARPA, we got to the end of the grant and, oh my God, we actually had something that could be used in the field and it became a product. So the research grants ended. Well, I got to imagine the same thing's happening at Microsoft. So some of the topics that they've been researching are pretty mainstream now and got rolled into bigger projects. Like a good example is the Trustworthy Computing Group. A lot of the research they need to be a little, I think my opinion is they need to be closer to the actual products that need to be trustworthy. So maybe we'll have a lot more cross-pollination in some key products.
Right. Curtis, let me ask you about this. There has been a lot, of course, of bile about this, that this is short-sighted, this is stupid, why would you cut a research group? Chibert offered one explanation, which is they're trying to integrate some of those people, some of those assets, some of those resources into other product groups, maybe even to other research groups. There is a common knowledge that there are research groups spread throughout the world. Maybe they only wanted one on the West Coast, and that's now going to be at Redmond. the question I have for you is, looking forward, sort of the 10-year future, is this Microsoft pulling back on research, or are they just pruning the research tree? Are they saying, okay, there have been a couple of decent developments, but we want to see more, and we think this reshuffling will help you focus?
I think it's perhaps a pruning, or the way I would tend to characterize it is perhaps a refocusing. They're looking at research areas, and as Brian said, some of the things that these groups have worked on have been included into the mainstream products. They have been, in the jargon of the industry, productized. In other cases, we've already heard from Nadella that he wants to refocus the company. And I suspect that what they're doing is, as you put it, pruning some of these efforts in order to not only spend resources on the new areas, but to signal to the organization that they're going to be focusing on those new areas. There's nothing that refocuses attention like making a drastic move. And this is, because of the number and because of the location, a somewhat drastic move. So I believe that what we're seeing is Nadella putting his stamp on the organization, saying that his words about refocusing are going to be backed up with action, and tie that to some natural pruning. You have what appears to everyone to be some fairly drastic action. I'm not sure that the results will be as drastic as the news reports indicate.
Right, right. Now, Chiebert, there is a bit more panic involved with the second round, and I think that's partially because in the first round, in that 13,000-person layoff that we had a few months back, it was mostly Nokia, and we knew that. It was the division that they acquired that they really didn't want anymore, that they didn't really need. They got the branding, they got the IP, they didn't need the workers. But this round has people getting cut at Redmond. I believe there were 60 jobs that were lost in California. There was 170 that were lost in Washington. There were a big chunk that were lost from research centers around the globe. There's one more round to come. What do you expect?
I got to expect that, you know, Microsoft is changing radically the way they evaluate employee performance. You know, we saw that when some of our friends got laid off in that very first round before Satya Nadella came to power at Microsoft. So Microsoft, I think, really and truly needs to look inward. And what I think Satya's trying to do is he's trying to say, hey, we need people that aren't going to be playing in silos anymore. We need to be able to think across product lines. Let's shuffle some people around. Let's get the community, get the ecosystem into sharing ideas. I'm not Steve Ballmer. I'm Satya Nadella, and I want you to start sharing information. And when you start killing divisions and then moving people around, you're breaking down silos. And I think that's what Microsoft is trying to go for, because they need to really reinvent themselves, especially if they want to do things like increase the ecosystem for mobility and have it woven through everything in their major product lines.
Well, folks, let's go ahead and talk about another one of those silos that got broken down, except it wasn't just breaking down a wall. It was a demolishing of it. Microsoft, in this cut, also destroyed the entire Trustworthy Computing Group. That's right. We've got a story here from The Register talking about how the Silicon Valley office wasn't the only research group to get the axe. Microsoft is closing the entire TWC, the Trustworthy Computing Group. The responsibilities of the TWC will be divided between the Microsoft Cloud and Enterprise Division and the Microsoft Legal and Corporate Affairs Group, which in and of itself is kind of a weird division. TWC was created 8 years ago after the dev work had been completed on Windows Vista. The idea was to have a division that was responsible for security and privacy that didn't have to answer to any other division. Now, they could sound the alarms when the other divisions did dangerous things, something that was difficult for those divisions to do on their own. Chiebert, you talked about this. You talked about the whole idea of inertia. Divisions are very reluctant to rat on themselves. They're very reluctant to say, we did something bad, we have to fix it. TWC was... it was born out of the mess that was Windows XP, all the security exploits that they had with XP that they didn't want to have happen with Vista. So they created TWC to say, you're the bad cop. You get to go around, point your fingers, and tell divisions they need to clean up. Why would you break that down?
Well, we can speculate all we want. And my silly wild ass guess is, gee, we're getting rid of an awful lot of people. If you don't want to be next, you need to go and start marching to the tune of the Sacha Nadella drums. And having everybody leaning on something like TWC might have been a crutch. You know, of course, this is me guessing. Now, taking a lot of the people from the TWC and then salting them throughout the divisions, well, it might be good, or it might just be like in Russia where you have a political officer on every submarine and every ship, someone to rat within the division. And in this case, I don't mean rat in a bad way. It's maybe it's from the inside getting people to realize that they really do need to speak up. And having someone from TWC that has had that situation, you know, had the freedom to speak up, maybe they're going to try and change things from the inside of the divisions that traditionally haven't spoke up.
Right, right. Now, Curtis, it's interesting that Cheever talks about taking people from TWC and taking the resources from TWC and sprinkling them through all of the different divisions. That's actually the exact spin that Microsoft is trying to lay on this story. They're saying, we want the security researchers, these security folks, to work directly with the engineering departments of each dev team. And that sounds like a good idea, but wasn't that the whole idea of the TWC in the first place, to give them independence from a division so that they didn't have to, you know, compete within the people in the division for the resources of that division? I mean, I understand Brian's point that there was too lax of an attitude saying, well, TWC will catch all our security errors. But does this reverse siloization solve anything?
Well, here's something that I noticed. I haven't seen any numbers on precisely how many employees will be going to each of these divisions, but I thought it fascinating that one of the two areas that was called out by name where they're going to be going is the general counsel's office. Now, when I was at Black Hat, I talked to several large enterprise security pros who talked about the fact that the general counsel's office is taking the lead at a lot of organizations for forensics, for remediation, and for regulatory compliance, which, as we know, has been driving security for a number of years. I think what we have is a twofold thing. One, that Microsoft's general counsel's office is doing precisely what their customers' general counsel's office is doing. They're taking command of a lot of the security for Microsoft products. In other words, the group that would have to respond to any liability issues is being proactive in defending against those potential liability issues. The other thing this does is provide a group within Microsoft that understands how their customers are running security now. In the same way that we have seen companies respond over the years with security going out to consultants or back in-house, being done by generalists versus being done by specialists, with the large vendors responding in kind, I think what we're seeing now is Microsoft deciding that it is going to act in the same way its customers are acting, so that they have a better sense of how to provide the products and services that those customers are going to need. I'm not sure how much of the total change that's responsible for, but I certainly see it being a very realistic consequence of sliding employees out of the trustworthy computing group and into the general counsel's office.
Well, gentlemen, let's go ahead and move away from that story. I think we've talked about Microsoft a bit. We'll have a chance to talk more about Microsoft, especially when that third round comes around. But now I want to talk a little bit about hacking in China. There was a report here from the Register talking about how an audit conducted by the information provided by the FBI, the Defense Security Services, Defense Cybercrime Center, and the United States Air Force organizations on organizations contracted to the United States Transportation Command, or TRANSCOM, had been hacked a total of 50 times between June 12th and June 2013. Now, this includes 20 hacks that could be directly attributed to the alleged Beijing-backed hackers group. Transcom is responsible for co-opting civilian transportation agencies in a time of war, and they would have had sensitive information pertaining to the United States' response to aggression. Now, included in that group of information, that data that was taken, would be email accounts, usernames and passwords, documents, spreadsheets and databases, flight details and encryption keys. Chibit, let me throw this over to you first. I think for me, the scariest thing about this is not that they were hacked, because agencies get hacked, but that they only detected two of the hacks. In other words, they were completely unprepared for securing the data that they were supposed to be safeguarding. This is pretty common in contractors, right?
All too common. You know, if you get what you pay for, and it sounds like they didn't spend enough money and time on securing their systems. Now, I am going to point out one thing. This doesn't sound like, you know, at first glance, to be terribly a big deal, but, well, if you've got names and flight details and a lot of things like that, now all of a sudden you know who is going where and what type of person is going where. That starts coming up with a thing called capabilities and capacities, which is the holy grail of classified information. So it doesn't sound a big deal, but it actually really is. And someone needs to go and have the back of their head slapped really hard, and they need to go and start actually using some of their budget to secure their systems. Because this is bad juju, whichever way you cut it.
Right. Curtis, this does seem to reveal a major flaw in the way that traditional government security models work. The traditional security model is that you have some sort of massive system that has state-of-the-art protection. You keep people out. You keep people who are in from authenticating to data that they're not supposed to have. And that's how you protect your data. Well, this says that's great and all, but at some point you're going to talk to a contractor. The United States military uses contractors for everything. And if the contractor systems are not secure, then you might as well not have that big monolith of security, because at some point your sensitive data is going to be vulnerable on their systems. Is this even a consideration in the enterprise? Because the enterprise has the exact same problem. We spend so much money on securing the enterprise, and then we let someone walk out the door with a USB drive, assuming that they're not going to do something stupid with it.
Right. And assuming that someone's not going to do something stupid with a small, portable, easily lost piece of hardware is just a really bad way to build a security model. Now, I think one of the interesting things here is that, as you say, we've had tons of resources thrown into the notion of building a stronger fortress. And what we now know, it's been proven over and over again, is that the fortress model is broken. It's irredeemably broken. What we really need is a model that says that we make sure that data is not useful when it is inevitably compromised, and that we are able to respond as rapidly as possible to intrusions and attacks. I did some work with a couple of security companies probably 3 years ago, longer than that, 4 years ago now. And they were all about this notion of responding rapidly to intrusions. They were a major supplier to the government and to government contractors. Their leader had come out of government, was talking to government people, and yet still, people don't believe that. People believe somehow that if they just have a strong enough firewall, that all of their troubles will be over. I don't know just how big a breach it's going to take to convince them that that's a bad idea, but that breach is coming.
All right. Achievert Bugs has in the chat room says, well, his corporation has encryption on all their computers, even the desktops that are not leaving the building, which is a good idea. But you actually have some personal insight on what's required of contractors for sensitive projects.
Yeah, part of the problem is that there is a set of regulations that have a whole checklist that goes down the line on how you're supposed to audit, how you're supposed to secure, how you're supposed to separate, how the rules are and how you handle sensitive information, and under what circumstances people can get to it. Now, here's the problem, though. More and more, we're getting contractors that have never served in the military, that have never been a federal employee, that don't know about the ramifications, shall we say. And I've seen that a lot, especially with research projects going around. And the people just don't have the same kind of awareness, shall we say. And the other problem is the certification process has been so Byzantine that a lot of organizations have taken a lot of shortcuts. Oh, it's good enough, you know, is heard way, way, way too often in contractors. So, folks, there is a reason why there's been so much effort put into things like the NISPOM Chapter 8. It is all about making sure that you go through that checklist. What hasn't happened is there used to be a lot of organizations where we would get together on a regular basis and share our notes so that we know how to do it. Just because you don't know how to do it doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. So, folks, come on. It's not that hard. Just go through the checklist. It's a good system. Contractors, you have to do the same thing. It's a law.
All right. Well, gentlemen, I want to evolve this story a little bit with one last bit before we head over to our special guests. And that is China's response. China, of course, has said, well, we're not hacking. We haven't supported any hackers. In fact, there's a story here from Network World that talks about how China has very strongly objected to being accused of this. They claim that, and I quote, Chinese law bans all the activities that sabotage internet security, including hacker attacks, and resolutely combats relevant criminal activities. Now, you can laugh at that or not. I mean, I don't want to talk about whether or not one country is hacking and another is not. I think we in this day and age, we pretty much know that every country with the capability is trying to hack every other country. That's just how it works. But here's the point for me, Cheebert. I want to bring you back into this because both of us had a little experience of this at Black Hat. The zero transparency problem has really bit us in this issue, in this contractors being hacked. A story also from Network World talks about how of the 80 contractors who were involved in this audit, who all had security breaches, only two of them reported back to the U.S. Transcom, the United States Transportation Command, because they were afraid of losing their contracts. This speaks to the zero visibility of the problem that is these attacks. They should have been on the horn saying, we think we just had a security breach. Could you send over some of your data professionals? Oh, and by the way, could you warn all the other contractors on your list? Because someone's probably coming after them. What's your take on this? I mean, we talked a little bit about how do you encourage people to admit that they've been breached in order to get help. But it seems to me there's such a long way to go before you're going to convince a company that has a multi-million dollar, maybe multi-billion dollar contract to say we screwed up.
Well, look at it this way. Look what it took before government regulations started forcing people into doing the right thing. Sarbox, come on. You know, we all remember Enron. Sure, there's a lot of people that, well, I don't want to endanger our contract. Yeah, it took government regulations to actually force them to do it. It shouldn't have taken government regulations. They should have gone and say, excuse me, despite our best efforts, we still got hacked. And here's how we think they got in. Could you make sure that someone else didn't make the same mistake? Learn from your mistake? Yeah, that's really going to happen when $1 billion is on the line. Yeah, Java, yeah, it is definitely covering your behind.
Yeah. Now, Curtis, as Cheebert was calling for more government regulation, I heard an angry nest of hornets coming onto the internet to attack him and say, "Gah!" Is this the only way to do it? Is the only way to do it to look at more government regulations? And now I'm speaking specifically of the enterprise, because we have the same problem in the enterprise. No enterprise, especially retail or financial enterprises, wants to admit that they've been hacked. And they will delay and delay and delay and spin and do damage control to the point at which the trail has gone cold. How do you entice, maybe not a contractor, maybe not a government organization, but let's say a financial institution who has an inkling that maybe there's a there's a flaw in their ATM security.
There really are two possible solutions, and each of them involves government, just different branches of government. One solution comes through the path that Brian indicated. More regulation, more laws, ideally laws and regulations designed by people who know what they're doing. That's the really iffy part of that whole chain. The other one is taking advantage of the judiciary. When those who are affected, whether it be a corporation that is impacted, individuals who have an impact, or the government itself, just sue the living daylights out of offending companies, win, and continue winning all the way through the appeals process. Once companies realize that either through regulatory penalties or through civil penalties, they face the possibility of truly massive damage to their bottom line through lack of security, then we'll see a change. Without that specific stick, then it's going to be business as usual. It's got to hit them on the bottom line one way or the other. And as I said, we just sort of have to choose which branch of government is going to be the entity wielding the stick.
Gentlemen, I want to thank you very much for that discussion. Security is something that we're always going to be talking about, but it's nice to air it out every once in a while and see where we stand. Now, when we come back, we're bringing on the founders of IDIS Networks. You may remember them from a successful Kickstarter. They're interested in protecting the Internet of Things. They created the iGuardian, which brings enterprise-class protection, and they're going to describe what that actually means, to your home devices. But before that, I want to take a moment to thank the second sponsor of the Twiat Riot, and of course, it's TechServe. Now, we are seeing some amazing technologies being deployed on the iPad today. It's a force multiplier, a way to get your message out, a way to make sure that people understand that you are customer-centric. Businesses keep coming up with creative ways to service their customers, to increase productivity among employees, and make more money with the same resources, all by using that iPad. For example, the Institute of Culinary Education equips students, faculty, and chefs with the iPad, empowering them to do away with heavy and unwieldy textbooks and streamline the learning process. A cable services provider in the Northeast gave its field technicians, who, when you think about it, are the public face of the company, iPads that had been configured to provide better service to customers. And retail companies have enhanced their in-store customer experience by using the iPad, not just as a point-of-sale device, but also as a spot where customers can learn about sales, special offers, and upcoming events. Now, these clients and more have turned to TechServe, the country's largest Apple reseller that sells, supports, and manages the largest iPad deployments in the world to manage their iPad projects. If you're considering adding iPads to your business, well, why not ensure your project's success with an experienced partner? TechServe assists businesses of all sizes to deploy Apple solutions, as well as solutions from Avid, Adobe, and more throughout the United States. No matter if you've started deploying iPads already or are just getting started, TechServe can help. And right now, TechServe is offering a complimentary download just for my listeners who are deploying iPads or who are interested in learning more about doing so. Go to techserve.com/twiat-7sins to get access to the 7 deadly sins of iPad deployment and see the common pitfalls that throw companies for a loop during their iPad deployments. This complimentary download is available right now just for Twiat listeners at TechServe.com/Twiat-7sins. We thank TechServe for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get to it. We bring back to the show two gentlemen who made quite a wave in the field, the ocean of security. It's Jacques Breitweiser and Daniel Ayoub, the co-founders of IDIS Networks. Gentlemen, thank you very much for coming onto the show.
Thanks for having us.
Now, gentlemen, you have just completed a successful Kickstarter. You were Kickstarter for the iGuardian. You were trying to raise $125,000, which did seem like a lot at the time. It didn't start super, super fast. But you picked up a lot of acclaim, everyone from This Week in Enterprise Tech, too. I think Forbes actually did a story on you. And what did you finish with?
We ended up at 140% being overfunded, so 175,000 roughly. And Honestly, I mean, thanks to you guys. And I think when we were over here and had our chance to tell you about the project, I think there were a number of people from your audience who actually backed us. And we were just blown away by the support. So thanks, everyone out there.
Right.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And Daniel, it wasn't just This Week in Enterprise Tech that you were involved in. We did a video for KnowHow,
yes,
where we explained what the device did, how it worked, how you were actually taking the same processors that are used in enterprise-class firewalls and putting them into this iGuardian. Now, can you just re-explain really quickly why you did that, what this device does?
Sure. So rather than using, you know, commodity-type processors that are relatively cheap and very common, we actually needed pretty high performance to be able to do the level of inspection necessary to be able to process all the traffic that goes through people's networks without slowing down their internet connection too much. In order to do that, we really had to leverage some of the more business class or enterprise class solutions. And one of those was integrating the Cavium Octeon processors in there. So those are specially optimized network security processors that are really kind of tuned and utilized mainly for deep packet inspection and really good traffic kind of analysis type of applications.
Right. Gentlemen, Kickstarter is known for being a buzz for many, many different types of endeavors. Security is not one of them. Kickstarter doesn't do security really well. So obviously something was special about the iGuardian. You pitched it specifically at protecting the Internet of Things. Now, just as a service to my audience, I think I want to step past the buzzwords. We all know generally what the Internet of Things is supposed to be. Everything is connected to the Internet. What do you see as the Internet of Things? If a layman was to come up to you and say, you protect the Internet of Things, what is the Internet of Things? What would you tell them?
So I think I'd start with saying, you know, basically anything that you connect to your home network these days that's going to be accessing the public Internet or reaching out and enabling remote access from the outside, those are the kind of devices we're talking about. So you have things like your thermostat in your homes now, you have your IP cameras in your home, you have your video game consoles, your streaming media centers. Basically, a lot of these kind of devices that people are enabling and putting on their DMZ or being able to access it remotely so that they can watch their dogs when they're at work, things like that. Those are all the kind of devices we're talking about. There isn't really a good solution today to be able to mitigate a lot of the risk and the vulnerabilities that are found in those devices. It's not like you can go installing antivirus software on your IP camera. And then, you know, really the only way to fix the flaws once they're there is to patch the firmware. And I don't know that it's really realistic to expect grandma to update the firmware in her router whenever there's a security vulnerability that's discovered. So we kind of viewed that the iGuardian was the ideal solution of being something that's very effective, very affordable, yet very easy to use. So that was kind of the thought that we put into developing it.
Right.
And Padre, when you look at the Internet of Things and when you ask the question the way you did, then actually it's I think you always almost have to turn around a little bit and you have to think about the devices that you don't think about as of part of the Internet of Things, right? When you think of your smart TV or when you think of your cable box or, you know, things like that you just plug in and you don't even consider them to be problematic, or you don't even consider them to be that kind of special installation that you maybe have when you install a webcam. So there's definitely also devices that just latch onto the internet and to your home network naturally, and you don't even think twice.
Right, right. Now, gentlemen, let me ask you about this. We seem to all agree that the Internet of Things is inevitable. Eventually, everything will be connected to everything else. But, and I'm going to sound like a Luddite here for a second, why do we want the Internet of Things? If security is going to be such an issue, if I'm going to need something like the iGuardian to protect grandma because suddenly her refrigerator is online, then why are we pushing for this? Why do we need to have all these devices for all these data points?
I think it's not really a question of why. It's just a question of here it comes, get ready for it. I think everybody now is wanting more data, more information. They want to have the convenience and more connected devices. I mean, you look at the craze with smartphones and tablets and just how technology has exploded over the last few years. It doesn't seem as though it's slowing anytime soon, and I don't think that the trend is going to reverse. I think, if anything, the problem is going to grow exponentially, and you're going to have even more devices in people's homes. why they would want it. I think it's just, you know, as the ball gets moved forward, the normal kind of shifts along with that and people get more accustomed to it. Why would anybody have wanted a smartphone 10 years ago? Now everybody has one, right? Similar kind of thought, I think.
Who would ever want a computer in their house?
Right. Well, you know, I mean, you joke, but I think everyone, all the hosts and all the guests on the show right now, were alive at a point at which a computer didn't go in your house. A computer went in a room somewhere at the office, exactly. Far, far away. Yeah. Maybe you had access to it every once in a while, but it was definitely not something that you would consider holding in your pocket because the thing weighed 400 pounds.
Yeah, yep. Exactly.
I remember being the first person on our block to get our 286. So,
hey, I had an 8088. Had to build that thing from scratch. All right. I want to bring in my hosts here, Brian Chi and Curtis Franklin. Gentlemen, the Internet of Things, it's much maligned because it does sound like a buzzword, right? I mean, Chibert, we talk about the Internet of Things and we kind of roll our eyes because we go, yeah, of course, everything's connected, but it sounds like just a selling point. But as a researcher, as someone who works at a university, you've got a different approach to the Internet of Things, a different take on what it can provide.
I actually build a lot of things that would be considered a part of the Internet of Things. And I gotta really point out one thing. You know, a lot of these people that are building the smart TVs, or they're building, you know, internet-connected DVRs, or, you know, Roku box or something, it's not that much different from what we're starting to see, you know, like SCADA. You know, it's being added, but they're not putting a ton of effort into it because they're more interested in the entertainment, or they're more interested in features. One of the things that I've really discovered when I start looking at the Internet of Research things is, oh my God, the network stacks on those things are pieces of nastiness. So, you know, there's not a lot of effort put in. You know, the fact that, you know, some of these SCADA devices, I look at it sideways and it'll crash. I will say a lot of consumer devices are better, but not by that much. So I put an enterprise-grade firewall on my home for a very good reason, because I know how weak the security and how weak the internet stacks are on a lot of these extremely inexpensive devices. I mean, I just bought a Blu-ray player for $60, for God's sakes, and it has Netflix and Amazon and all kinds of stuff on it. So I don't think they put a lot of effort into security. And oh, by the way, when I did run an enterprise-grade firewall shootout, I use, you know, the firewalls I tested all had the same kind of processors that Daniel and Jock are using in the iGuardian.
Right, exactly. No, it's the same processor that I believe the one that they're using has fewer cores, but it's got the same capabilities. Curtis, JJ to the 44884 makes an interesting comment in the chat room. He says, Internet of Things, just more things to exploit at the next Black Hat / DEF CON. And, you know, that's kind of my thing. I'm like, I can't wait to the Internet of Things because I want to be able to hack way, way more things that are out there. But from an enterprise perspective, this is not a good scenario. I mean, yes, you can get a lot of data, but it also means way more points of entry for an intrusion.
Well, and let's admit that what we're now referring to as the Internet of Things for the consumer has existed to a large extent in the enterprise space for a long time. We have had instrumented remote locations. I mean, think of oil fields, think of various mineral and natural resources extraction, think of transportation, think of manufacturing. All of these are very heavily instrumented activities. And what we have found out in the last couple of years is that they are areas in which the computerized systems have been protected kind of not at all, either because the engineers who put them together just never imagined that someone would want to hack them, or because they had a touching childlike faith in the concept of security through obscurity. Gee, if we don't tell someone that our automated factory floor runs with computers, they'll never try to hack it. Well, we see just how successful that is. So I think for the enterprise, they are several steps ahead of the consumers when it comes to the enterprise of things. What this does for the enterprise is provide, as you said, another entire attack vector via the Internet of Things in the consumer space. Because as we've seen with BYOD, remote workers, the partners that we talked about, it's entirely possible to have government contractors who are sole proprietors working out of a home office. All of these will have Internet of Things installations in place, and therefore all of them will need to have enterprise class security to protect the enterprises with which they work.
Well, when we come back, I'm going to ask Jacques and Daniel to show us how we protect that Internet of Things that we seem to be both wanting and so afraid of. But before that, let's thank the third sponsor of this episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. They are part of the Twilight Riot. It's Prosper. Now, what if I told you that in 72 hours, you could have $35,000 to cover your needs? Well, what would you do with it? Would you consolidate your high-interest credit cards? Would you start a business? Would you finally do that home improvement that you've been putting off year after year after year? Well, one more. What if I told you that by filling out an easy online application and providing a few details, you could see a rate for that loan online, instantly, without ever stepping foot in a bank? Well, that's not fantasy. That's Prosper. Prosper offers low fixed rates, unsecured personal loans, which means no collateral is required, and has multi-year terms available. I remember a long time ago when my computer consultation firm, this is way back before I was a priest, it grew past my resources. It was doing really, really well, but I needed money to cover the contracts that I was going to get paid for. That meant I needed a loan from a bank. And that process, well, it was just a nightmare. It was as demeaning as it was confusing. Going from one bank manager to another and showing them that my business was incredibly profitable, I just needed a bridge loan to complete the next round of contracts. Well, I wouldn't have to do that today because I'd have Prosper. If I had Prosper back then, I could have saved myself the wear and tear of the bank shuffle and gotten the cash that I needed immediately. Prosper is an innovative peer-to-peer lending process. It's Silicon Valley's answer to a more modern community-based personal loan. There are no outrageous fees, no rising interest rates, and yes, you'll never step foot in a bank. They have more than 2 million members, lenders, and borrowers, and over $1 billion in funded loans. Folks, this is peer-to-peer lending. They connect people who need money with those who have it to loan. It's really that simple. This is the way that we'll be doing business. Just go to prosper.com/twit to check your rate instantly without affecting your credit scores. For a limited time, Prosper is offering Twit viewers a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get a loan. Go to prosper.com/twit. That's a special site just for our viewers. Up to $35,000 in just 3 days and a $50 Visa prepaid card. Go to prosper.com/twit. That's prosper.com/twit. And we thank Prosper for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Jacques, Daniel, this is where we break out the knives. This is where we get to the meat. We know this Internet of Things is coming. We know it's inevitable. How did you choose to protect it?
I think the choice or the way that we viewed it is really intrusion prevention or an inline intrusion prevention system is one of the only ways to be able to mitigate a lot of the risks that we see. There have been a number of studies that have come out that show that there are massive vulnerabilities or that there are a lot of holes in the types of devices people are having in their homes. It doesn't seem as though there's a good solution to it today other than to manage it at the network level. And the way we kind of solved it was a very simple inline device. You plug it in between your modem and your router, sits on the wire as a bump in the wire, inspects all the traffic coming in, going out. If there's a pattern of known attacks that matches one of the rules on the box, it'll drop the offending packets and reset the connection. It's kind of interesting because if you look at a lot of the consumer electronics and things that you'd find in people's homes, they're relatively low cost. They're designed to be cost optimized. And they're designed to be made as cheaply as possible. That often means recycling of code. That often means using commoditized versions of software that maybe aren't really the most or the safest or the best way of doing it. And it also means that they're usually very slow to release any kind of patches. But if you think about just any kind of connected device that you have in your home that has a embedded web server running on it, I mean, as Curtis pointed out, These are simply small embedded computer systems that you're plugging in all over your house. If there's any kind of flaws in the software, the things reaching out on the public internet, it's just an open door for somebody to come, or an unlocked door, I should say, for somebody to come and open.
Okay. So, I got to ask you, Daniel, because there are going to be people in the chat room who are saying, well, what are you doing different that I don't already have with my, let's not say bargain basement router. Let's say I have a decent router that's protecting me. It's doing a stateful packet inspection, and it's looking at the traffic that's going into my network, and it's making sure that no hostile traffic is going to come in over ports that should be closed. So what does your solution do that solution isn't?
Yeah, so it's kind of a fundamental shift in the approach. We're not really concerned about ports so much, and it's not really looking at stateful packet inspection. Basically builds a state table in memory. So it keeps track of all the outgoing connections, and it says, okay, this connection was coming from this computer on this port. When we see the return packet coming in, we know that it's authorized because we kept track of it when it went out. But what it's not doing is actually inspecting the contents of that incoming session to see if it's really legitimate code or if it's nefarious code or if there's an attack or a piece of malware in there. If you request the data, it's going to give it to you. That's basically it. The other thing is, you know, you think about the way the consumer market works today. Usually, if you're going to plug in a device that needs access, you're going to be doing some sort of port forwarding or you're going to be doing some sort of DMZ. Those devices are essentially sitting there on the public internet at that point for anybody to come tapping on or knocking on. That's kind of the difference, I think, between the two is the stateful packet inspection firewall will give you any data you request. It's not going to care what the contents of that data is. And IPS is actually going to inspect the contents of all the packets, make sure that it's nothing dangerous that's coming back in.
Right. We've got DLR and James T who are in the chat room talking about their airport extreme router or talking about how Tomato or DDWRT, how could that protect? But all of those just use SPI. What you're talking about is a different level of protecting the Internet of Things. It's not just, well, you should be allowed through and you shouldn't. It's, hey, what are you carrying with you?
Yeah.
This is a much better way of doing security. In fact, this is why enterprise firewalls use the same Cavium processor that you're using in the iGuardian, because you need that processing power to actually look past the headers and actually into the payload and say, wait a minute, why is a bunch of personal text being sent out to the internet? That doesn't make sense. You know, normally an SPI would just look at that and say, oh, there's a computer sending data. I better allow it. Your system would say, I don't think this data should be leaving the network. I'm going to close this down.
Yep. I think the if we look at it just from the stack of the OSI model and we say that a stateful packet inspection firewall typically operates at layers 2, 3, and 4, whereas this type of an appliance would operate at layers 5, 6, and 7. So it's doing 2 through 7, not just 2, 3, and 4. You can do all the firewalling that you do with the normal stateful packet inspection firewall, but now you're looking at the session, you're looking at the data itself, you're looking at the packet contents and the payload, as you said, and kind of matching that at the application layer. That's a much different kind of approach. That's a much more processor-intensive type of search, especially when you think about people having millions of packets coming in and going out. That can be a very big challenge, and that's part of the reason why the consumer routers, it's not simply putting a new firmware on the box to make it be able to do this. They really don't have the compute power, the RAM necessary to be able to do it. It's not something you can do with cheap hardware. That's part of the reason that we set out to build the purpose-built hardware platform that we did.
Right. We've got Web 2513 in the chat room who is, and this is our audience, this is what they do. He's saying, oh, this is still nothing new. Well, what about zero-day attacks? So I mean, you are a signature-based solution. Yep. How would the iGuardian respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a similar kind of problem that you're going to face in the enterprise today, right? It's, protect the herd, not necessarily the individual, right? So the first attack may come through, but the larger base, the people that are getting the updates, those are the ones going to be protected. And I think, again, it's a very, very similar type of approach that you see in the enterprise now. Now you have virtualization, you have sandboxing, you have a couple of different techniques to be able to detect that stuff. But again, not something that's really Prevy in the consumer market quite yet. So we view this as a very good first step, let's say, first line of defense that really when you look at what's available to people at their houses today, there's really nothing even close to what we're trying to offer. And I think that's the big difference is really taking that same kind of concept or same type of technology that you'd find, protecting a business and making it easy, affordable, and effective for a home environment.
Right. I mean, I think the retail price is going to be $175. The Kickstarter went from $125 to $149. Yeah. So, yeah, at this price point, let's all agree, at this price point, this ability doesn't exist outside of the IE Guardian. Curtis, I want to throw over to you because we did have that discussion in the Enterprise Bite about, well, attackers realizing it's no good attacking the enterprise anymore. I'm going to attack the edge. I'm going to go after the weakest link, and the weakest link is going to be that remote worker. It's going to be that contractor that doesn't have the strict security that you do at the corporate office. This is one of these devices that could change that, right? I mean, if the edge now has at least some of the same protection that the enterprise has, it no longer becomes as big of an attractive a target.
Well, I think it certainly changes the profile of a lot of attacks because, let's all admit it, most hackers, most criminals, when you get right down to it, are essentially lazy. They will go after the target of greatest opportunity. Right now, that is likely to be the home office worker, the small office, the 2-3-person remote office somewhere. If you can harden those, then you force the criminal to look elsewhere. And for a non-trivial percentage of those, that's going to take them to a place that's beyond their technological capability. So you really start that filtering process. Now, I think we have to admit that there is a level of attacker who is going to be at most delayed slightly by this. But you certainly do winnow out a lot of the garden variety riffraff with something like this because you make it either too much work or way too difficult for them to do against your particular target. Send them over to your competition. That's a time-honored tactic.
Right. Now, Jacques and Daniel, again, we've got DL on our chat room. I love our chat room. He's asking a good question, which is, could we do this with an old PC and the right software? And the answer is yes. I mean, because your solution is open source based. People can get the software that's running on it. I believe it's running a fork of Linux, and it's got AirSnort that's driving a lot of the analysis. But the package here is that you've made it so easy. I mean, you can dive into it, but you could also just plug it in. This is something that I could send to a completely untech-savvy worker and say, plug this in. And only when you have this plugged in will I allow you to VPN into our network.
And that's essentially, you know, also when I looked at the post from Web 2513 earlier, still nothing new. That's true, right? I mean, we don't reinvent internet protection or protection of the network. But the point is really that it's in a package, just like you said, Padre, it's available in a package that is extremely easy to use, even for those who don't want to, who have the capabilities maybe to build it over the weekend or over a couple of weeks, and who don't want to spend the time, aside from the hardware, which we think is actually fairly decent and very attractive. But if you don't want to spend the time to compile everything, you can just use the box. And for the other group of users that we're going after, the consumers who really don't even speak about attack surface and who don't even understand that term, for those people, it's just the easiest and most effective way to just secure their home network and be done with it. Set it, forget it, and be done.
Yeah,
right.
I would say to anybody that, you know, you can build your own system. You can, and that's what a lot of folks out there, the more techie audience, they'll do things like that. They'll take an old PC and convert it. But I challenge you to find a comparable piece of hardware at the price point that we're offering that can give the same level of performance. And then I don't think you're going to spend less than 3 or 4 hours probably getting the system up and running, fully tuned, fully optimized. And then the last part of it, or I guess the other thing that people often overlook, is if you're using an old x86 platform with a 300-watt power supply in it, you know, as opposed to a small lightweight box that consumes 10 watts. What's that going to mean in the long term of leaving that thing on all day, every day, for a year at a time? What's the impact your power bill going to be? And I think there's a lot of reasons why, and then, you know, just the maintenance of the thing. There's a lot of reasons why, even if you have the skills and you have the ability, it might not be the best way to go. Sometimes it's just easier or better to go that way. So we've actually been pretty hard at work on getting this thing up and going. What I've got up there on the screen, that's the the Cavium Octeon 3 reference design board that we've been working on and porting the code over to. So we've actually got most of the code base now ported over to the MIPS platform, and I've got it running now as a transparent bridge with Snort in line, and it's basically just sniffing all the traffic coming in and going out. So you can literally plug it in now, and it just works. So that's part of what we've been working on now is just getting the code optimized and ported over, and that was a big challenge in itself. So very happy that we're making a lot of progress there.
Right. Cheebert, you do this for a living. You test firewalls. It's one of your things. I understand you actually do have an iGuardian in your lab at the moment, yes?
Yes, I do.
And you've been hammering on it?
I have not had time. Unfortunately, the day job is just sucking up an amazing amount of time. However, I will say Jock and Daniel and I all met each other in a previous life where we were dealing with enterprise-grade firewalls, and I really beat the crap out of a whole bunch. Now, just to put this into perspective...
You set one on fire, Cheebert.
Yeah, actually, I did. It was a router, but the router took 3 fire extinguishers to put out. But anyway, when we did the firewall test, it was really truly clear the differences in classes. The Sonic Wall that won the shootout stopped 98% of the CERT-based attacks, you know, basically the entire CERT collection I was pounding at the firewalls. And it only let that last 2% in because the tool that I was using required that ICMP be open. Now, on the other end of the spectrum, one of the lesser expensive firewalls from Zyxel really only stopped a little over 25%. And the really inexpensive ones that you could buy at a consumer store stopped at best 5%. So that's wow. 95% of the CERT-based attacks that were available, not even zero day, these are just already understood attacks, got through an SPI firewall. And just to put it in perspective, that inexpensive firewall, we managed to destroy it. We literally, it got so crazy, it actually overwrote its own code, and we had to send it back to get it flashed because we couldn't even reflash the firewall.
And, of course, the iGuardian is using the same Cavium processors as were in that Sonic Wall.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. Well, all right, that speaks to us. Gentlemen, I want to thank you so very much for being back on This Week in Enterprise Tech. It is always a pleasure to talk to you. I'm going to give you the parting shot. If you could please tell the folks where they can find the iGuardian. I know the Kickstarter is over now, but if their interest has now peaked, if they're now looking at a way to perhaps protect their Internet of Things, what should they do?
Very easy, very straightforward. Kickstarter is over, like you said, but we're still taking orders. So if you want an iGuardian, if you want to get your hands on it, send us an email to info@idisnetworks.com or just wait a couple of weeks because we plan on actually going on Indiegogo to use that as a platform to get some more folks interested and hopefully get some more home network connections secured. So either way works, and we're hoping to see additional interest there.
I think my co-host and I can I think we can all speak with a unified voice saying the more of these devices that make it out in the world, the easier it makes our job. Because if you can protect the edge, if you can keep the users of our enterprise class networks from getting infected with all sorts of funky stuff, it means less attacks on the enterprise network itself. Again, I want to thank you very much. That's Jacques Breitweiser. I had it. Breitweiser, right? Breitweiser and Daniel Ayoub from IDIS Networks, the co-founders of a new company that I think is going to take the enterprise home. I also want to thank my co-host, Mr. Brian Chi and Mr. Curtis Franklin. Brian, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you when you're not sintering laser material sticker thingies?
Okay, I've got some stories that should be appearing, I'm hoping, middle of next week at infoworld.com. And I am currently eating the learning curve on doing advanced LTE testing, which I hope will be appearing someday in the future at Tom's Hardware.
Ooh, okay, very cool. LTE testing with maybe an iPhone 6?
Who knows?
Okay. Thanks, you tease. Also, I want to thank very much Mr. Curtis Franklin. Again, Chiebert, Curtis, and I have been together for a decade now covering Enterprise, having a good time, and it's never more fun than Mondays when I get to sit with them. Curtis, could you please tell people where they can find you and where they can find your radio show?
Well, doing a lot with Information Week, of course. We have Dark Reading Radio on Wednesday this week, and something new for those of our listeners in the financial services industries. Starting on Tuesday, the 22nd, 23rd, Tuesday, tomorrow, Bank Systems and Technologies will have its very first radio show with a PayPal executive talking about how they do what they do and why. That's at banktech.com at 11 a.m. Eastern Time tomorrow, Tuesday. And I'm getting ready, packing up all my stuff in the Pelican cases, because this time next week I will be in the Big Apple getting ready for a week's worth of live shows at Interop. Going to be doing 8 live shows there most days, 11 a.m., 4 p.m. Catch me there at informationweek.com.
Best place to go if you want to know what's going on at Interop. Gentlemen, thank you so very much. It is always a pleasure to have you, and also to our special guests, especially who came up into the studio on a Friday. Yes, this is a pre-recording. Braving the traffic to talk about IDIS Networks and the iGuardian. But I also want to thank you. That's right, you, the person who stayed and watched the best dang podcast, Enterprise podcast, in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 firewalls, the 10th being the one that Chiebert set on fire. But, well, we want to do something for you, for coming back each and every single week to download your Enterprise goodness. What we want to give you is a way to get Twiit into your device of choice automatically. If you just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiit, which obviously is on fire right now, you can find all of our episodes. If you want to find out where you can get the individual episodes, they're right there. If you want to find out how you can get the RSS feeds so you can get Twiit downloaded in its audio format into your iPhone or your Android phone so that you can listen to it on the way to work, or maybe into your tablet so that you can watch the standard definition version while you're on your break, or maybe into your laptop, your desktop, your Mac, your PC, so you can watch us in our high def goodness on your 60-inch TV. You can do it right there, twit.tv/Twiit. Also, don't forget that you can find me on Twitter. That's right. Go to twitter.com/PadreSJ and follow me. If you follow me, you can find out what we're going to be doing on each and every single episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And you can also talk back to me. You can tell me what you want to see so we can custom the show for you. You also find out what the Digital Jesuit does when he's not on Twiit, including the other shows I do here on the Twiit TV network. Mondays at 2:30, you'll find me for This Week in Enterprise Tech. On Tuesdays, you'll find me at 7:30 for Padre's Corner, where I get to talk about anything. And on Thursdays, you'll find me twice. Once at 11 o'clock a.m. for Know How, where with Brian, was his name Burnett? I forget his name. It's something like that. It's Cranky Hippo. He's my TD right now. He doesn't have a camera on him, so he's upset. But yeah, we talk about projects that you can do in your own geek time. And finally, at 1:30 p.m., you'll find me with Shannon Morse for Coding 101, where we teach you how to be a code monkey, all times in Pacific. I want to thank also all the people who made this show possible, to Lisa and to Leo, to Carson, my super producer, and to Brian Burnett, who, do you want to say a couple of words to the folks at home, Brian?
No, I think you've said just about everything, Padre.
Thanks. It's always encouragement from the Cranky Hippo. Until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballasair, the Digital Jesuit. And remember, if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep Twiit.